Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
I think it's really special that 1.5 million people want to come to the little town of 30,000 that I live in because of its beauty.
The first cruise ship of 2023 docks in Juneau. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, April 19th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, researchers are collecting hair from humans to study mercury levels in fish.
The bigger the fish, the larger fish they can consume, and those tend to be at a higher position in the food web.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Construction season is here, Alaska. Avoid surprises on the drive. Before getting on your way, check 511 for traffic delays. For current traffic information and road conditions, visit 511.alaska.gov or download the app or call 511. For more detailed information about DOT construction projects, visit dot.alaska.gov/construction. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities.
The Alaska legislature has seen several proposals for statewide taxes this session, and that will apparently also include a sales tax bill from Governor Mike Dunleavy. There are some other tax bills filed, including a different sales tax proposal, an income tax proposal, and 2 bills that would make changes to how oil companies are taxed. All of them are aimed at reducing budget deficits as lawmakers try to fund state services and permanent fund dividends without making huge cuts. Alaska Beacon reporter James Brooks says that in closed-door meetings with legislators Tuesday, Governor Dunleavy said he planned to introduce a bill that would institute a 2% sales tax. But Brooks notes, as of today, details were still scarce, and any tax proposal would be tough to pass in the next few weeks remaining in the session.
It really seems like a stretch to think that there'll be significant action this year. The legislature can always surprise you. Things can move quickly when there is consensus. But the issue right now is that any tax proposal, legislators, and it sounds like the governor has said as well, needs to be part of a package of multiple bills. And until I see it, I really don't believe it.
So the governor is supposedly going to introduce a sales tax bill, but that's not the only idea for a tax in Alaska, and it's not even the only idea for a sales tax in Alaska, and there is another bill out there, right?
Right. Representative Ben Carpenter of Nikiski has proposed a 2% sales tax bill already, and that's been discussed somewhat in the House Ways and Means Committee. That's basically the first stop shop for any fiscal measures at this point in the House. It hasn't advanced beyond that. We also have seen an income tax bill proposed by Representative Elise Galvin of Anchorage. We've seen a couple oil tax measures, one from Representative Cliff Groh of Anchorage, the other from Senator Bill Willikowski of Anchorage. But all of those measures are still at a fairly early state in development. One of the big things that came out of Tuesday's meetings with the House and Senate was that the governor seemed to be changing his position on new taxes. I don't know that for sure because I haven't heard it directly from him, but in prior statements during his first term in office, the governor said that any statewide broad-based tax needs to be approved in a vote of the people, a statewide referendum. In these meetings, legislators said the governor didn't mention that idea anymore. And it seemed to them like he was saying that he's willing to accept a tax without a statewide vote. That's a pretty significant deal. And the governor's willingness to examine taxes and potentially accept them is itself a big change.
Right. How would the sales tax work again? And I guess, what is the criticism of that? I mean, I've heard that it would be difficult in rural Alaska, and explain that to me.
Yeah, one of the drawbacks we've heard in legislative committees is that because prices are higher in rural Alaska, rural Alaska would pay a disproportionate share of any statewide sales tax. So if your gallon of milk costs you $10, that 2%, the 2% of $10 is a lot more than 2% of $4 or $6 for a gallon of milk in Fairbanks or Anchorage. There's also a concern about sales taxes in general that lower income, poorer Alaskans will pay proportionately more of their income in sales taxes than richer Alaskans. The counter argument to that is that if you use sales tax revenue to boost the permanent fund dividend, that actually benefits the poorer Alaskan more than a sales tax hurts them. Because let's say you've got a $2,700 permanent fund dividend, as has been proposed by the House. If you have to cut that in half in order to balance the budget instead of passing a sales tax, then that takes away the same amount of money from everybody, whether they're rich or poor. And that $1,350 that you've taken away from a poor Alaskan is going to be a greater percentage of their income than that same $1,350 taken from a rich Alaskan. So there's definitely trade-offs in this policy debate that's going on.
Yeah, definitely trade-offs and definitely a debate.
Very much. And we're in this position because it hasn't been resolved since 2016 when Bill Walker vetoed half the dividend as a cost-cutting measure.
Right. And I mean, people have speculated too that even if it's difficult to pass any kind of a tax bill this year, it may be more difficult the next time around because that's coming up on a campaign season and any idea of a tax seems like it might be unpopular to some people.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And in addition, there's always the chance that legislators can simply roll the dice and hope for higher oil prices. Back in the spring, the State Department of Revenue estimated oil prices in the 70s for the next 12 months or so. Right now, prices are higher than that, and legislators could simply look at current prices and say, well, we're going to gamble that those prices are going to remain where they are. We'll pay for whatever deficit there is from savings and see where we end up next year, and then pick the ball up next year.
That was Alaska Beacon reporter James Brooks. You can find his work at alaskabeacon.com. The Alaska Black Caucus is suing the municipality of Anchorage over the city's failure to put body-worn cameras on police officers. The lawsuit filed today comes more than 2 years after voters approved the purchase and implementation of the cameras. The Anchorage Police Department and the Police Officers Union remained locked in negotiations about the policy. Rich Kirtner, an attorney with the Alaska Black Caucus, says it should not be taking Anchorage this long to get cameras in place. Police departments across the state, including in Nome, Kenai, and Juneau, all have body cameras on officers.
It happens everywhere else except Anchorage, and there's no reason why it shouldn't happen, and especially since the voters not only voted to support this, they supported it with tax money and property taxes.
Voters approved a $1.8 million tax levy in April 2021 for the purchase and use of body-worn cameras by Anchorage Police. The Anchorage Police Department and the Police Officers Union have opted to bring in an outside arbitrator to settle their dispute over the camera policy. The start of that arbitration has been delayed until fall. Kirtner says the Alaska Black Caucus has asked officials with Mayor Dave Bronson's administration multiple times for information on the delay, but they've been stonewalled.
Well, who's the arbitrator? When is it going to be scheduled? Everything has been like in the dark. What are the issues? Why is the union and the police department not able to come to some type of agreement on the policy?
A spokesman for Bronson declined to specifically address the lawsuit. He wrote that the mayor is in favor of getting body cameras on officers as soon as possible, writing, quote, "body-worn cameras are good public policy and will enhance transparency for both the public and APD," end quote. Kirtner says the Alaska Black Caucus agrees with that sentiment and is hopeful that their lawsuit will solve the dispute. The nonprofit is asking a Superior Court judge to declare that the city must comply with the will of the voters and move to get body cameras on officers.
One of the things we suggest is some kind of a master help make them negotiate a settlement on this, but they should be able to settle themselves, and the sooner the better.
Anchorage Police Spokeswoman Renee Oystad said the department will host a news conference related to the lawsuit tomorrow morning. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, winter conditions could lead to ice jams and flooding this spring.
The longer we stay cold, the more likely it is that we're going to snap up to some warmer temperatures and really shock the system.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health, but did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by Snap.
On Monday, the first cruise ship of 2023 docked in Juneau. On that same day, city officials signed an agreement with the cruise industry to start limiting visitor volume. Starting next year, there will be a limit in Juneau of 5 cruise ships per day. It's a rare example of successful negotiations between a port city and the cruise industry, but some community members say it doesn't go far enough. KTOO's Anna Canny has more.
The 4,000-passenger Norwegian Bliss is docked right downtown. It towers over all of Juneau's buildings. The first cruise ship visitors since October are streaming off the boat, looking to start their iconic Alaska adventure.
It was on our bucket list. Always wanted to come to Alaska.
It's always been on Michael's bucket list.
I'm hoping to see the Northern Lights. That's on my bucket list. And the glacier.
Whale watching.
We hope to see some whales today.
We're going to whale watching.
Whale watching? Tour managers are ready with a flurry of maps and flyers. But not everyone is feeling so welcoming.
We don't like to annoy, if you will, the passengers, but they need to know. Cruising has consequences.
Sue Schrader is with a small group of protesters holding a massive banner. They hope passengers can see it from the boat's deck. It says, communities against cruise pollution. Juneau's port only has room for 5 ships at a time. Some days, 2 ships will dock at different times, so there can be a total of 6 in a day. Across the industry, cruise ships are getting bigger and carrying more passengers. A day with 6 full ships could double the population of Juneau. A new agreement between cruise lines and the city will scale things back a bit by introducing a 5-ship daily limit. 5 ships is still a really busy day, but it's possible that stopping at 5 is the most Juneau can do. The new limit is actually not even enforceable. But city tourism manager Alexander Pierce says it could give the city more breathing room. And it could also pave the path for future negotiations with the industry.
So we're able to articulate what we actually want to be as a tourism destination over the next 10, 20, 50 years, and then starting to focus on how we maximize the economic benefits to the region. Given that cruise tourism isn't going away anytime soon, but we can work to make things feel a little bit more balanced.
Working closely with the cruise industry seems to be the best way to find that balance. If the city pushes too hard, the industry pushes back harder. That's the lesson Juneau learned in 2016, when it got sued by the industry for how it was using the per-person tax it collects from all cruise ship passengers. And of course, the community has long been divided in their opinions about cruise tourism.
Welcome to Juneau, everybody. Have a great time. Glad you're here.
Back on the docks, longtime Juneau resident Tom Sullivan says it's an honor to welcome so many visitors.
It's a very important economic driver in our community, but more importantly, I think it's really special that 1.5 million people want to come to the little town of 30,000 that I live in because of its beauty.
In the season ahead, Monday's visit will seem quiet by comparison. There are a lot of 6-ship days coming up. And when all is said and done, more than 1.5 million visitors will have come and gone. In Juneau, I'm Anna Canny.
It's an unpleasant fact for everyone who eats fish in Alaska. Mercury is in the food chain, and it's particularly prevalent in seafood. And while the amount of mercury found in Alaska seafood remains far below dangerous levels, a pair of researchers want to keep an eye on it long term. The best way to do this, they've found, is not by testing fish coming over the docks, but by testing human hair. They're in Sitka to report the findings of a pilot study begun 5 years ago. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Todd O'Hara is a veterinarian, but don't bring him your cat to be spayed.
I'm a veterinarian who has a PhD in toxicology. I've never had any desire to be a clinical veterinarian. I've applied my veterinary degree to wildlife and fish research in toxicology and environmental agents of disease.
O'Hara is a researcher with Texas A&M and the University of Alaska Fairbanks. A lot of pathologists who study human disease are veterinarians, which is not surprising when you consider how closely humans and animals are linked on this planet. Maggie Castellini, however, is not a veterinarian.
Maggie's a marine mammal physiologist, by the way. I don't think she mentioned that.
No.
She's actually trained in marine mammal physiology.
That's correct.
Which greatly applies to what we do.
We'll come back in a moment to why a marine mammal physiologist is important to research about mercury in seafood. Castellini, until last summer, was with the UAF College of Natural Sciences and Mathematics, working in the vet department. In 2018, she and O'Hara won funding from the National Institute of Health to study the accumulation of mercury in the marine food web. The pair had often been to Sitka for the annual symposium on humpback whales called Whale Fest, and the community, they realized, provided a diverse pool of people who live closely with the marine environment. They launched a pilot study hosted by the Sitka Tribe of Alaska and began to collect samples, not of the sea creatures consumed by Sitkins, but of human hair, which can reveal a lot about the head it's growing out of.
Hair is just a really easy tissue to be able to work with. It's a very good indicator of mercury in the rest of the body. It's obviously very easy to sample. You don't have to, you know, stick a needle in somebody or anything like that. We would just take a very small, maybe about the width of a pencil from the very back of a person's scalp, and also something that's pretty easy to analyze as well after the fact.
The pilot study tested mercury levels in the hair of 70 subjects, both in Sitka and in another smaller community in southeast Alaska. The objective was to be as broad-based as possible, rather than focus on any specific ethnic group or demographic. Really broad-based.
One of the things we like is when vegans and vegetarians participate in the study, because that shows us sort of a control non-meat consuming person. So we had a vegan here.
The upshot of the study is that the tested population showed mercury levels far below the cutoff for the World Health Organization. O'Hara says most people came in at around 1 part per million of mercury. A couple of people were at 5 parts per million. The WHO cutoff is 10 parts per million. This is good news for Alaskans who live by and from the sea, but it's not the full story. Mercury accumulates in different species at different rates. O'Hara and Castellini want to expand mercury monitoring to better specify any risk.
For a long time, the types of advisories that would be sent out, and there still are in some parts of the country, basically treat all fish as equal, right? You know, don't eat more than this many meals of fish a week if you're a woman who's a childbearing age. But that's not at all true with mercury. Some species of fish have vanishingly small amounts of mercury because of their lifestyle, whereas others, you know, especially the bigger ones, can have fairly high.
The bigger the fish, the larger fish they can consume, and those tend to be at a higher position in the food web.
And higher still are marine mammals. Alaska, the pair agree, has a pretty good advisory system for fish, but not for the animals that eat those fish.
So we would like to include marine mammals in our study to give people here in southeast Alaska a better representation of their diet.
Some places are famously contaminated with mercury. San Francisco Bay with Gold Rush-era mining residue. Minamata Bay in Japan, with industrial mercury at such high concentrations that the resulting neurological damage is called Minamata disease. Alaska's mercury is less likely to be caused by human activity. There's naturally occurring cinnabar, for example, and volcanoes. O'Hara and Castellini hope that their pilot study with the National Institute of Health will take off into more permanent monitoring of mercury in coastal Alaska. They see monitoring as an incentive to a healthy diet rather than a deterrent.
If that's all people hear about, then they start to be afraid to eat good, healthy foods. And so it's really nice to be able to get a broad study where we can look at communities and say, you might eat a lot of fish, but your mercury concentrations in general are still not that high. And it's a good reassurance.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Sexual violence affects nearly every household in America. If someone you love has experienced sexual assault or abuse, it can be a lot to handle. Reach out to the National Sexual Assault Hotline today to learn how to support someone you care about. Call 1-800-656-HOPE or visit RAIN.org. That's RAINN.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
There's an above-average chance of ice jam flooding for most mainland Alaska rivers this spring. Speaking during an Alaska Center for Climate Assessment and Policy breakup presentation yesterday, climate specialist Rick Toman listed factors elevating ice jam flood potential, including an above-normal snowpack. Toman displayed a color-coded graphic of October through March precipitation.
You can see over most of Alaska dominated by those green colors indicating significantly above-normal precipitation.
Toman highlighted especially high precipitation in the upper Tanana Valley into the Yukon, as well as much of the Northwest Arctic Borough.
More than 1.5 times average precipitation over a 6-month period. That is really quite remarkable.
How fast the abundant snowpack melts and releases water into rivers hinges on spring temperatures, and Toman said April has been cold.
Historic level cold for this time of year across a large chunk of Alaska. Even in the eastern interior, Fairbanks 6th coldest the first half of April, and Anchorage about 10th coldest.
Toman shared temperature outlooks that point to the trend persisting.
Quite a strong signal for continued below normal temperatures the rest of this month.
The longer the cold lasts, the greater the risk of ice jam flooding, according to Alaska Pacific River Forecast Center hydrologist Selena Van Breukelen.
The threat there is that the longer we stay cold, the more likely it is that we're going to snap up to some warmer temperatures and really shock the system.
On the plus side, Van Breukelen said ice thickness is generally below normal, but she highlighted unusual conditions that have elevated ice jam concerns at Buckland on the Buckland River in northwest Alaska, Circle on the Yukon River, and Aniak on the Kuskokwim.
They had either a midwinter breakup or they had very rough freeze-up conditions, meaning that their local ice is going to be thicker than normal and is going to, you know, require more force in order to move out.
Looking statewide, Van Breukelen said river ice breakup dates are forecast to be from a couple days to nearly a week later than normal. Arctic scientists are on a mission to better understand beavers in the far north. The population is growing rapidly and having multiplying effects on the Arctic landscape, especially permafrost thaw. In early April, a team of researchers traveled 400 miles by snow machine across the Seward Peninsula from Nome to Kotzebue, marooned for days in blizzard winds and heavy snow as part of the scientific expedition. KOTZ's Desiree Hagen reports.
As the tundra thaws due to climate change, beavers are moving in. And scientists say this new beaver boom is actually encouraging the permafrost thaw. Ken Tape is a research professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, studying climate change in the Arctic. For the last 7 years, he's focused on beavers in northern Alaska.
How rapidly they're moving into these new areas and how dramatically they change the landscape. For me, that's just been really impressive and a little bit scary.
There is only one species of beaver found in North America. Castor canadensis is the Latin name. And after decades recovering from overtrapping, these large semi-aquatic rodents are experiencing a new resurgence, especially in northwest Alaska. Since 2016, TAPE's research group has identified more than 12,000 new beaver ponds in the northern Alaskan tundra. And he says beavers are gaining a foothold.
They're, you know, moving across northern Canada, northern Alaska, and western Alaska. They're really moving into these new areas. But actually, western and northwestern Alaska, in a lot of ways, has seen more rapid change than a lot of areas.
TAPE is just back from a two-week scientific expedition with fresh insights. Earlier this month, he and two other researchers, as well as Kotzebue-based writer Seth Kantner, traveled over 400 miles by snowgo across frozen tundra and sea ice, pinpointing beaver lodges along the way from Nome to Kotzebue.
We haven't done this Nome to Kotz trip. You know, last year we snow machined a little bit more around the Seward Peninsula, but this year we wanted to bring the snow machines up to Kotzebue.
TAPE says beavers are making a marked effect on the landscape, affecting fish habitat, thawing permafrost, and changing the course and hydrology of streams. In addition to warming localized areas, TAPE says the beavers are also encouraging more biodiversity as they bring new species along with them.
They're really ushering in and accelerating this new Arctic, you know, warmer water, longer summers, enhanced vegetation growth, thawed permafrost. All those types of things are coming along with beavers.
TAPE and his researchers are using satellite imagery to catalog beaver ponds in northern Alaska and comparing new data to archival aerial imagery of the region from the 1950s onward.
There are very few animals that you can see their footprint on the landscape from space. One of them is humans. One of them is beavers. There really aren't very many others.
Also on the latest expedition was research professor Benjamin Jones, who has been doing fieldwork in the Arctic for over 20 years. He says there's a gap in research observations on beaver activity in the region, and being on the ground in the spring months is important.
Researchers, you know, oftentimes they go out in June, July, August, and then they go back to their university and start teaching classes. And I think it's an important time of year since the Arctic is, you know, winter, fall, winter, spring, 9 months of the year. So
Jones says one of the advantages of traveling during the winter on snowgoes is that there is less environmental impact, with fewer disruptions to wildlife and subsistence hunters. But it isn't without its challenges.
I mean, we got stuck in a pretty much 48-hour ground blizzard where our entire camp just got consumed by blowing snow. You know, so it's just part of the adventure of science, you know, doing science in remote regions.
The group plans to return to the region this upcoming August, where they will travel to field sites along the Kobuk River to continue monitoring the growing beaver population boom and changes to the Arctic landscape. In Kotzebue, I'm Desiree Hagen.
That is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Wesley Early in Anchorage, Anna Canny in Juneau, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Desiree Hagen in Kotzebue. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com.
And by
Alaska Air Cargo, providing Gold Streak Express shipping for urgent deliveries throughout Alaska, with connections to more than 100 destinations in the lower 48 and Hawaii. More at alaskacargo.com.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.